You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is Jennifer Ashley Tepper, and you're listening to the Untold Stories of Broadway podcast. Today, I am so excited that my guest is Richard Maltby Jr., a writer who I've been obsessed with for many years. You might know Richard Maltby Jr. as lyricist of musicals like Baby and Big, Closer Than Ever, Starting Here, Starting Now, Miss Saigon. He also, in 1978, directed and conceived a little musical called Ain't Misbehavin', which played the Longacre Theater, and he has some incredible stories about it that we're so excited to share with you. Hi, everybody. It's Jennifer Ashley Tepper here with the Untold Stories of Broadway podcast, and I'm here today with the great Richard Maltby Jr. So Richard is someone who I have worshipped since I was a child as a lyricist, as a director, as a theater artist. I grew up obsessed with many of his musicals, a lot of which I'm going to be asking him about today. And today's episode is about the Longacre Theater. The Longacre, located at 220 West 48th Street, was built in 1912. It is named because of Longacre Square, which is what Times Square was originally called before they changed the name to fit with the newspaper. One of my favorite facts about the Longacre is one of the earliest facts, which is that Harry Frazee built it. He was the owner of the Boston Red Sox and known for having sold Babe Ruth's contract to the Yankees to finance his theater ventures. And because of that, there was a rumor that there was a curse on the Longacre. So now the first fact I've given you on this episode is about sports, which is very weird because we'll probably never talk about sports again. So without further ado, I want to welcome Richard Maltby Jr. to the podcast.
Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for being here.
Well, I love the Longacre.
I love that you love the Longacre. Some of my favorite stories I've heard about it were from you, and I'm excited to get to that.
Well, when Ain't Misbehavin' was moving, and it moved on an incredibly fast trajectory, I was taken to pick a theater. Can you imagine? I was taken to 8 empty theaters to given my choice of which one. And I picked the Longacre, which was not a popular theater. It's not on 45th Street or 44th Street. It's not a, in those days, walk-in trade meant something. So you wanted the theater to be where people walked so that they could walk by and go, oh, I want to see that and buy a ticket. The Longacre was, you know, two blocks off of that. And so it wasn't a popular theater, but it had an oddity. The stage was low, lower than most stages, comparably the music box, which is where Dear Evan Hansen is playing here, is quite a high stage. This one was low, and as a result, the cast could have access to the audience. This was all about the cast playing off the audience, and in fact, with Joan Lee Beatty, we actually added two steps down from the stage with sort of strip lights on them so that the actors would actually step down to kind of make contact with the audience. I wanted the actors to be able to really, I wanted the show to make contact with the audience. And so I really liked that. So when I came back and told Manny Eisenberg, who was producing it, that I wanted the Longacre, there was this big long pause. Nobody wants the Longacre. It's like, you know, nobody wants the Longacre. Aside from other things, it also has a second balcony, which means though it has 1,000 seats, you know, 150 of them or something are way up high, and they're hard to sell. So, you know, but I was the director. The show was a big success, and everybody treated me very well, so I got what I wanted. And it actually, everything about that turned out to be exactly perfect. The show had this tremendous immediacy with the audience. But after a year, the fact that you couldn't sell the second balcony and all of that began to sort of build up. So we moved to the Plymouth Theater, where we played for 2 years, and then we moved to the Belasco and played for another year. So, but the Longacre was wonderful. And the this show was went into Maine Mr. Papin went into rehearsal on January 1st of that year of 78. It rehearsed for 4 weeks. It opened on February 1st, closed on March 1st. On April 1st, it went into rehearsal for Broadway. On May 1st, it opened on Broadway. And on June 1st, it won every award you can win. Yeah. So I just thought that's what, you know, theater is like. I should say, when we went into rehearsal, we went into rehearsal in the cabaret space at the Manhattan Theater Club, a room that they didn't know what to do with. And we, you know, they sort of, Lynn Meadow sort of twisted my arm and said, I don't know what to put in there in January. Come on, do that show. You were all excited about Fats Waller. Why don't you do that show? And so I said, well, okay.
I love that. And it led to the longest running show at the Longacre.
Is it the longest running show at the Longacre?
Yes, it is.
Oh, my God. How very, very nice.
I'm going to make you rewind. I want to hear more about the beginnings of Lynn Meadow. You go way back with her and just the beginnings of your roots as a musical mm-hmm. theater creator. So tell us about what was the first Broadway show that you ever saw? How did you get started in the theater?
Well, I don't know. My father was an orchestrator, and he did sort of symphonic orchestrations, and he was brought to New York when I was seven. And so I guess, what did I see first? I think I saw Carousel first. And I was sitting in the balcony, and I kept saying, when is the Carousel coming back? And my mother said, shh, quiet, next scene. If you remember, the scene after the Carousel is about a half an hour long. It's a big love scene, and I'm sitting there bored. When is the Carousel coming back? Next scene. Of course, the Carousel never comes back. And we got to the end of the show, and I thought, oh, that's okay. But I wanted to be a set designer. Mm-hmm. So what I loved was not so much the theater as the Ready City Music Hall. I loved the scenery in the Radio City Music Hall, you know, big overblown things. And my big excitement was that one year my father got to orchestrate the Easter show. So I got to go to the rehearsal.
Wow.
Which was so great. Those shows, they did four shows and five movies a day, opening at 9:30 in the morning. And they did it every day. So when there was a changeover, it happened overnight. By the time the last movie was starting, they were loading the scenery out and loading it back in. We drove in at like 4 o'clock in the morning. At four, the corps de ballet is on stage. At five, the Rockettes are on stage. At six, you know, and he took me underneath the stage where the hydraulic lifts are, and they did that Easter, the fat, big Easter pageant that took place in a big cathedral where everybody, the dancers, they were all nuns. They were all holding these great white lilies. And they were so beautiful. And I stood in the wings. And as they walked stately like nuns off stage, then tossed the old prop lilies into this basket, which were kind of gray and old. Anyway, I learned something because They did a dress rehearsal of the whole show that ended at about 9:30. The audience was already coming into the theater when they were clearing the tables. And they padded the show on the first day with some short subjects. They showed the movie, and then they started the show, and they had rewritten it. I didn't know you could do that. My little 7-year-old brain went, oh my God. I just didn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't what they had rehearsed 3 hours earlier. I thought that was wonderful.
So tell me about your time at Yale, and how did you get started as a lyricist and then as a director? What was that time like, and your early years in New York?
Well, I always wanted to be I wanted to be a set designer. I wanted to, you know, which lasted all the way through my second year at Yale when I discovered that I couldn't draw. And that was like the end of that. My roommate was John Conklin, who was a world-class opera designer. It was clear I was not in that league. I wanted to do musicals because the scenery is more interesting. And I put on some kind of show in eighth grade. I wrote a musical in my senior year at prep school. You can find somebody to write the book and you can find somebody to write the music, but nobody wants to write the lyrics. So by just process of elimination, I wrote the lyrics. I had no interest in being a lyricist, but I just wrote the lyrics. I then went to Yale because Yale had a theater. Mm-hmm. Harvard didn't, but Yale had a theater. And in my freshman year, I met David Shire. I came to Yale to write musicals. He was a composer. He came to Yale to write musicals. There was nobody else. I mean, we didn't all that much cotton on to each other immediately, but there was no way we weren't going to work together because there was nobody else. And we started, and we wrote two musicals. We were at Yale, and the first one, our first attempt, we decided to adapt What Makes Sammy Run, the Bud Schoberg novel. And we were all trotting along until somebody pointed out that you can't do it unless you have the rights. I didn't know that you had to get rights. So the next year we picked something in the public domain. So we picked Cyrano de Bergerac, wonderful romantic thing, great. We didn't sort of factor in that we were picking the period with the most elaborate costumes that ever was. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody is going to wear incredible clothes. We're doing a Yale Dramat with no money. You know, I don't know how we did it. We got one of the women in the who was a costume major at the drama school did it. These incredible clothes appeared, and the show is really sumptuous. We had a full orchestra. Mm-hmm. We had New York orchestrator came up to orchestrate it. It had five huge sets. It was a big deal. And we also decided to tour it because in the Cole Porter days, the shows would tour after they were done. They were done at the Schubert Theater, and then they would tour. So we thought, well, of course we'll do that. And we got sort of picked up. And so we did it at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival Theater because the Yale Club of Fairfield County decided to sponsor it. And we brought it to New York and played at the Phoenix Theater for one night. It was all fine. I was the treasurer of the Dramat.
I didn't even know that.
I was the treasurer and I had it all worked out, except that I didn't factor in that stagehands have to get paid. You know, in the theater, in college, you just stay up all night.
Right, right.
Years later, I met Hal Prince, and he said, you know, I saw Cyrano at the... And I said, you did? Why on earth did you do that? He said, oh, we were all there. Everyone in New York was there. I said, you were? He said, yes. I mean, a show from Yale was coming into the Phoenix Theater. Of course we were going to go and see it. I said, well, why didn't anybody say anything to us? We didn't hear anything.
For people who don't know, the Phoenix is a fascinating theater. It's where the Golden Apple started before it moved to the Alvin, which is my, you know, favorite Phoenix fact. But it was like a beloved off-Broadway theater where lots of shows played.
More than an off-Broadway theater. It was a full-size Broadway house.
Yeah, they did shows sometimes that I think campaigned to be considered Broadway and were.
Yes, and it was T. Edward Hamilton and I can't remember the name of his partner. Decided to do a sort of repertory theater, and they produced sizable number of plays, starting a whole bunch of careers. Really, really interesting work.
Yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And so Cyrano, I know there's like a recording that I've heard, but there are songs from that that have ended up in other projects of yours. So what songs from that?
David and I recycle everything. Autumn.
Yeah.
Which is one of the first songs we ever, the first really good song that we wrote. The first moment that I really knew David was a writer. Barbara Streisand recorded that, and that sort of.
Do you want to tell us how that happened? Because it's a great story.
Well, when we came to New York, I can't exactly remember the sequence of events, but Peter Daniels, who was Barbara's arranger, who did all the arrangements for those early albums. Heard some of our songs somewhere and got to know David. And he kept putting these songs in front of Barbara. And, that's what you do with Barbara. You don't tell her you don't ask her to do a song. You place it on the piano and just don't say it's there until she says, "What's that?" "Oh, this is not for you, Barbara. It's not for you." "What do you mean it's not for me?" "What's for a man?" "Oh, I want to hear it." So that's what he did with Autumn, which we always thought was going to be a song for a man, he then went on to be the pianist for the new musical Funny Girl that was coming in, and then assistant conductor, and then he ended up conducting about 100 performances of the show, which was fun.
So you're these Yale students who've written this song that Barbara Streisand's recorded, and you've moved to New York, and you're writing musicals together. What were the first shows that you and David wrote together that happened after college?
Well, we did a review called Graham Crackers that was at the upstairs at the downstairs. Ronnie Graham, who was the star of New Faces of 52, was doing a show and looking for people, and we happened to have some songs. Crossword Puzzle is from that, Autumn is in it.
You can hear Autumn and Crossword Puzzle on any recording of Starting Here, Starting Now. That was a plug for one of my favorite musicals.
Cool.
Sure. I like that.
It's still out there. Somebody just called up and said they want to do a big production of it in Toronto.
Yeah, cool.
I said, yes.
That's great. I can't see the Statue of Liberty without singing crossword puzzles, so it sticks with us all.
Well, that's good. That's good. So, you know, we did that. Ronnie was incredible. He was a manic genius, and he would improvise a sketch, just improvise it, and it would be flawless. It would be just perfect. And we were laughing. And we said, Ronnie, we just got, let's write that down. And he would say, write what down? Had no memory of what he had just done. And I mean, I kept trying to be a stenographer. It was before you had little recording things in your hands. Mm-hmm.
Can you also, what was upstairs at the downstairs like for people who didn't know it?
Well, there were a series of sort of chic supper clubs that did after dinner shows. Mm-hmm. There were a lot number of people who did them. Bill Ben Bagley was one, but sort of the most chic, the most epicene of them all was Julius Monk. Mm-hmm. He had this club for himself called the Upstairs or the Downstairs. He also then moved on to the Plaza Hotel and did a show called Plaza 9 that ran for, you know, 10 or 15 years. The people were always in tuxedos. The women were always in evening gowns. And it was all very, very chic. Mm. There were songs like Fifth Avenue Buses Never Go Out Alone. that sort of comedy. We played a song for him about David's first brownstone in New York. And Julia said, no, David, we don't do songs about first brownstones. We do songs about the doorknobs on brownstones.
Wow.
But they were very chic, and a lot of really wonderful young performers played there. And he was doing this one show at the Upstairs of the Downstairs. Pat Stanley was in it.
Mm-hmm. And from Goldilocks.
And Elaine Hanley, who had married Pat Stanley's husband.
Oh, gosh.
So she was Pat Stanley. It was the other way around. It was Elaine Hanley and Pat Stanley Hanley. That was
amazing.
They were in it. Who else was in it? There was a guy who went into MASH. His name, everybody's name, I just can't
pull out. So tell me about, because I am so curious, I always want to know about it, The Sap of Life, which I was in a theater all summer that was like a block away from where you guys played, and I would always go, that's where The Sap of Life played, right near Sheridan Square.
It's true. It's true. David and I wrote a second show at Yale, and we formed a real connection with people. There was a wonderful director named Bill Francisco who went on to teach at Wesleyan, and where his prime student was Lin-Manuel. So
there you go.
I consider that I'm responsible for that. he was a director. A couple of people wanted to be producers. We wrote this show that was based upon, there was a wonderful book by John Cheever called The Wapshot Chronicles. I picked it up and read the blurb on the back. And I thought, that is a really good story for a musical. I then read the book. The story in the book is not the story on the back of the book. So I thought, okay, we'll just write the, we'll extrapolate a story from the back cover of the Wapshot Chronicles. And then we don't have to pay any royalties. because we had learned by then. So we did it. And The Fantastics had just opened the year before, so the idea of doing a small show, you know, with real intensity was really good. We took it to Williamstown and tried it out. We did about 25 backers auditions in people's living rooms to raise $25,000, which is what you had to do to get the show. So it was $1,000 here and $500 there, and $2,500 maybe here. And And we did it. And we tried it at Williamstown. Then we brought it into New York. We had a different cast. It was not as good as the Williamstown cast when we moved. It only ran for 6 weeks. It didn't get terribly good reviews. Got one rave review, but a bunch of sort of okay reviews. But from our point of view, in the second week, Steve Sondheim came to see it. And the next week, he came back and brought Jerry Robbins. And the next week, he came back and brought Hal Prince and Leonard Bernstein. Somebody just called us up recently at a college someplace, it's Virginia Tech. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to do a concert version of the show. Nobody has asked us to do this show. There isn't even a legitimate recording of it. We did record the score, but it allowed me to listen to the score again. The lyrics there are a few really good lyrics, but mostly they're just sort of okay. But the score is breathtaking. I mean, no wonder Steve and all these people went bonkers for it. It was two pianos and a percussionist, and it was thrilling. I had sort of forgotten how completely wonderful it was.
There's that song "Love of Your Life" that is mm-hmm. as good as anything from a '60s musical. It's so poppy. It's so great. How? So did you feel like at that point, were you already working on other shows? Were there things in the pipeline at that point?
Well, we worked on a show called, an adaptation of Rumor Godden's novel, The River, which was a difficult show. It was mostly a kind of a tone poem. It didn't have a lot of story, but for some reason, I loved the movie, and the movie was by Jean Renoir. It was a beautiful, sort of evocative piece about an English family in India. Why we would choose this? What did we know about India? What did we know about India? What did we know about English families living in India? But we got pretty close to it, and then we did not get the rights from Rumor Godden, who wrote the novel. Mm-hmm. We were working on another project that was about John Reed, the only American who was buried in the Kremlin Wall. Mm-hmm. The subject of the movie Reds and we couldn't crack the story, but it was just this fabulous story about the radicals in Greenwich Village before the First World War, mm-hmm. in the years leading up to 1913 or whatever it was. So much passion, so much vision, for so much energy to create a new world. And of course, we were doing this in the 60s, where it had a certain amount of contemporary resonance. Mm-hmm. So we were doing that. When the movie came out, I saw it, and Warren Beatty had hired Trevor Griffiths, the really wonderful English playwright, and he wrote an opening scene. And it's so good, I thought, God, why didn't we think of it? Warren Beatty is a kind of John Reed was a kind of a charismatic young man, very, very attractive, and he's giving speeches all over the place, and he goes to, I think, Portland, Oregon, and this young woman wants to interview him. Well, he knows what that means. If a young woman wants to interview him, he's going to have her. And this scene goes on, and slowly he catches on that she wants to interview him. She wants to interview him because of the passion of his politics and everything else. Slowly he settles down and says, oh, and realizes he's going to spend the night talking to this woman. And then in the morning, she goes off to publish her story. They then meet again in New York. But it's just a great scene.
Yeah.
It's just a great opening because you know it's going to be one scene that it turns out to be something else. And I thought, I wish we had been smart enough to think of that scene.
Well, what I love about so many of those projects that you were working on is that in addition to the book musicals that you and David eventually ended up having, you know, produced Baby and Big and all the others, all of these shows ended up with material that a lot of them are in Starting Here, Starting Now or Closer Than Ever, which the next question I'm going to ask you for this is background on. But, you know, I was obsessed with the Starting Here, Starting Now and Closer Than Ever cast recordings and wanted to learn more about those songs. And when I found out that Pleased With Myself, which is an amazing song from Starting Here, Starting Now, was from a musical called How Do You Do, I Love You, of course, I tried to dig into what that was and became very much in love with that show, which I'm going to...
You should be committed.
Richard, I'm telling you, there's so much in that show that, like, when I first heard the recording from the out-of-town tryouts, you know, it's so funny and it so satirizes the social mores of that time. It's like a musical about computer dating from the 60s.
How did
you come up with that?
Well, it was Michael Stewart's idea. The computer he was talking about was those computers that filled up entire rooms in insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
This woman decided that she was going to make use of the database in an insurance company to find the most appealing eligible men in New York because she wanted to find a husband. I mean, not exactly the most feminist drive for a plot, but that was, you know.
It manages to satirize, so, you know, the opening or maybe the second number, The House is in Larchmont, it manages to satirize what was going on and why women, you know, might go on that mm-hmm. journey, as well as it was, you know, of its time.
Well, I think it's more satirical now than it was when we wrote it. But, we were doing a send-up of the... the things that women had to do in order to lead interesting lives. I mean, how they had to get jobs, which were manipulative things to get a husband,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the life that they were looking towards, like Houses in Larchmont. I mean, the shining goal for them was something that now we would just consider so limited.
Yeah.
And so, but that's what women in the 50s and 60s, that's what that was the goal.
Mm-hmm.
That's why women had so many nervous breakdowns. they'd go out and they'd have this happy life with children and everything, and they'd be in this house, and one day they'd just have a breakdown in the middle of the street.
Well, I think that's all in the musical in a pretty ahead of its time way. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Untold Stories of Broadway podcast with our guest, Richard Maltby Jr. Stay tuned for part 2, featuring more stories about the Longacre Theater. Thank you to our producer, Dori Berenstein, my publishers of the Untold Stories of Broadway, Brisa Trincaro and Roberta Pereira, Zach Zadek for that theme music, and thank you to all of you for listening to the podcast. You can buy the Untold Stories in book version on Amazon.com.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.